Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Why Would You Tell Me That? With me, Dave Moore, him, Neil Delamere, and you, the audience. We are so glad to have you. Wherever you are listening to this, would you do us a favor? Would you do two things? One, would you hit either subscribe or follow, whatever the language is on the player you're listening to, because then it means that you're always kept up to date with the latest happenings and Why Would You Tell Me That? And also, if you get a sec, throw us a review. A 5-star review would be nice. But the reason for that isn't just because we want to massage our egos. It is because the more reviews you get, the higher you go up in kind of the visibility to people who maybe don't know anything about the podcast, maybe from different countries or even from the same country. They just go, who are these guys? I just found them on the front page of the Apple Podcasts app or the Google Podcasts or Spotify or whatever it is. But any review, we'd really appreciate it. You can follow us both. I'm at Dave Today FM on Instagram. Neil is at Neil Delamere Comedy. And the show itself is at Why Would You Tell Me That? And I'll stop talking now because here's Neil Delamere.
And we're also proudly part of the Acast Creator Network. So if you haven't heard of the show before, one person introduces an amazing person in the second half who's an expert in their field. And we talk about kind of facts in that general area for part one. So Dave, in part two, we're going to be joined by journalist, author and broadcaster Richard Fitzpatrick. Now, he's based in Barcelona. He's written a great book on El Clásico and he's made a documentary, which is what we're going to talk about.
Oh,
called The Year General Franco Stole the Eurovision.
Ah, stop. I immediately assumed when we were going for he lives in Barcelona, he's written a book about El Clásico, this was going to be some amazing Barcelona Real Madrid fact or something. But you're contesting that Franco stole the Eurovision.
General Franco, amongst his litany of other, what can only be described as horrific acts, possibly stole the Eurovision.
I am as intrigued as I've been in any opening gambit from you, I have to say, because I'm a massive Eurovision fan. So the fact that somebody could besmirch the integrity of one of the world's finest contests is immediately intriguing.
Yeah, and it's for our non-Irish listeners, we're just saying seven times, isn't it? Seven times.
Do we need to explain Eurovision to anyone who isn't European? Maybe we do.
It's just a big Eurovision Song Competition and it includes Australia because it's actually decided, as far as I know, by the Broadcasting Corporation. So Australia's in it and Israel's in it. And yeah, it's just a big song competition. I think most people know what it is.
True. It is one of the most watched things. But I guarantee you there are a swathe of the people listening to this going, you're a what?
Yeah, it's like the Rose of Tralee with lyrics. Is that
better? Oh, nice. You've really picked a really international competition there that everyone's
internationalized. I think that's globalized, the whole idea. It's like the community games in Mosny, but with plinky, plinky, plinky and dung, dung, dung in the background.
Okay, perfect, perfect.
Can you see why I was sacked as the ambassador? Can you see? right, because we're talking about a dictator in part two, General Franco, the Spanish dictator, in case people don't know that, I thought we'd talk about dictator-adjacent facts in part
two. Love it.
Okay, so my theory is they should all release podcasts, dictators.
Dictators should release podcasts.
Yes. I'll tell you why, because if you want to inculcate somebody, if you want to kind of brainwash them, if you want to get them into how you think, you get them to listen on headphones.
What?
Because listening on headphones, a voice coming from inside your head, as it were, is twice as persuasive as one coming from a speaker.
You mean to tell me that we've had a podcast now for four seasons.
Kill them all, kill them all.
Yeah, and we haven't abused this power that we're literally in people's earphones. And I've had a radio show for 20 years, and I could have been, okay, we didn't listen on headphones for a long time, but now people do. So now we have more power than we assumed.
Yeah, and they have actually measured this, send stuff and gifts to Neil and Dave. They have measured this. This was done in UC San Diego's Radio School, UCLA, and UC Berkeley, right?
I'm a size UK10 in shoes, if anybody wants to send me sneakers. Send Dave sneakers.
Send Neil bigger cars. Don't mind sneakers. Wasn't good. So the idea for this study was sparked one day when UCLA Anderson School of Management assistant professor Alicia Lieberman, she turned on this podcast. She knows This American Life, right? Very
yeah.
popular podcast.
No, well, yeah.
But she turned it on in her car and she kind of went, Ira Glass's voice isn't doing the same thing to me it normally does. I'm not responding in the way I thought I normally would. And then she went, oh, maybe it's the headphones thing. So they basically did experiments, five different studies, 4,000 participants. This was amazing, I thought. In one experiment, subjects used either headphones or speakers to listen to a public service announcement about the dangers of distracted driving. And headphone listeners later reported being more concerned about the threat posed by distracted driving than participants who heard the messages via speakers.
Wow.
Yeah, because those ads are really affecting.
They
I don't
are,
know if you
yeah.
do you remember that ad? There used to be an ad, and the girl was in court. It was a road safety ad. The girl was in court, and she was testifying against the guy who hit her with the car, and she was injured. If you saw that ad on UTV, an Ulster television in Northern Ireland, the car in the ad had a yellow reg, a Northern Ireland plate.
Right.
And if you saw that ad in the Republic on RTE, the car had a white Republic of Ireland plate. And I always thought, what were the chances of a fella hitting the same girl on the same road in the same car, Dave? I would have thought that both of them would have learned their lesson from the first time. I think that was the point of the ad, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, you've obviously not listened to that on headphones because you've missed the point of that entirely.
I may possibly have missed that, yeah.
So hang on, I really can't believe that so people are genuinely more convinced of something because they're hearing it in headphones. I suppose it is such an intimate thing because coming from the world of radio, where by and large, and obviously times are changing, but up until, let's say, 3 or 5 years ago, most listening was done on radios. Radio was listened to on radios.
Yes.
It's the fact of the day. But that's a collective thing, as in everyone can hear it within the vicinity of the radio. But as soon as you put headphones in, whether it's radio or music or podcast or audiobook or whatever you're listening to, you are immediately on a one-to-one, or in this case, a two-to-one because Neil's here and I'm here, whatever. But it is so much more intimate. So I can understand the power of it, but I'm amazed that someone has actually studied it and found it to be true.
And I said twice as persuasive at the start. I think that figure comes from one experiment they did where this is really, I just think it's interesting that they even came up with this idea. They listened to a speech clip from a CEO whose company provides visual information for the blind, right? After listening to the speech, the participants were asked, would they write a letter in support of the CEO winning an award for her work? And people who had listened to the podcast via headphones were twice as likely to agree to write a nomination, 30%, as those who'd listened via speakers, 14%. And that was the only difference.
The only difference is headphones versus speakers. If you're listening to this on a smart speaker, turn it off immediately and put it in headphones. We need to be more persuasive.
Do you know sometimes you have one headphone in because you're doing something else and you want to hear? I mean, I wonder if that 50% is...
your right ear is really into whatever Neil is selling, but your left ear couldn't care less.
Could you only ever convince Van Gogh of maybe 50% of the stuff that you were telling him?
Luckily, he never had to deal with headphones, poor fella.
Yeah. Okay, so I think dictators should release podcasts. That is my first point.
Brilliant.
My second point is, if there was ever going to be a dictator who was going to release one, it is my favorite dictator. Now, this guy comes up, if you can have a favorite dictator.
I was just about to ask, are you allowed to have a favorite one? Okay, go on.
Well, it's like picking a favorite blood clot. It's not good, no matter what you pick. This guy used to come up on comedy shows all the time because of his shenanigans, right? He was in Turkmenistan for 15 years. Sapir Murad Niyazov died in 2006. Yeah, he named himself Turkmenbashi, or great leader of all Turkmen,
right?
Which is what you want. I mean, you want ridiculous statues and you want a ridiculous title, right?
Yes, definitely.
Okay, he went further. He changed the name for the month of April and the word for bread to his mother's name.
Ah, stop it.
Yeah.
His mam's name. Like Bridie or what? Turkmenistani yeah. version of Bridie.
I'll have a toasted sandwich, like just ham and cheese and two slices of Mrs. Varadkar. Is this sourdough, Mrs. Haughey, or whole grain, Mrs. Haughey? And the word for April as well. So like, when will we meet? The 15th of your ma. Yeah.
Two slices of your ma and a slice of ham. Imagine that in the deli, right? You want deli, go, hey, can I get a sandwich, please? Brown, white, or your ma?
Well, I'd look at your ma sandwich. I mean, that's perfectly reasonable as a thing to say.
Oh, my God.
Gurban Sultan was his mother's name, and that's what bread and maple were changed to.
Bread and, I mean, of all of the things, like, just two bizarre things to change the name of your mother doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, and he changed the city and the month of January, and both of them became Turkmenbashi. So him.
Him. So January is now called Turkmenbashi. Now, so again, if you were the dictator, it would be, children, everyone recite the months of the year. Neil Delamere, February, March. Like, that's what it would have been.
Did he go me, February, March? I don't know.
He would have had to, yeah.
My favourite thing he did was he wrote this. You want a tract, don't you? You want a Mein Kampf. You want something where your genius stroke insane ramblings are written down, right?
Yeah.
He wrote this book called The Runama, The Book of the Soul, a spiritual and philosophical tome. And he published it in 2004. And it had like history, philosophy, guidance, teachings, but this thing could come up, you had to learn it, and it could come up like in your driving test.
Ah, stop.
Or in job interviews, the incorporated material from the world.
You have to book. Quote from the book.
Yeah.
Like, as in, know it off by heart.
Well, you'd have to know knowledge of it. So, like, you're nervous enough doing your driving test anyway. So it's like, I'm going to hit the dashboard, and when I hit the dashboard, I want you to perform an emergency stop and just quote the first verse of the 1913 lockout by W.B.
Okay,
Yeats.
You've successfully reversed around the corner, and now please quote 7 lines from Homer's Iliad. Thank you. Like, what the hell?
Yeah. Now, you screeched. The brakes screeched, but they didn't screech in iambic pentameter, which is extremely disappointing.
This is insane, this guy. By the way, quick pop quiz. What's the capital of Turkmenistan?
It is Ashburat, is it?
He's going to know it. I was going to have jokes and all. I was going to say, it's the noise you make when you sneeze. Ashgabat! Of course, Neil Delamere knows what the Turkmenistani capital is.
Well, in fairness, I just read about the Turkmenistan dictator. I mean, okay. If you'd asked me week ago, would I have known it? I would not have known it because we haven't played them in an international UEFA group, which is what basically most of our geographic knowledge is based on. So we can say, you and I can say that we think that somebody might be unstable like a dictator or a leader, right? And we could say we thought Donald Trump was mad if we wanted, for example. And,
I mean, we wouldn't. We couldn't possibly. But if we wanted to, we'd have the freedom to do that.
We could say that.
Right. And
the one thing I did enjoy when he was president, I did enjoy when he went on a solo run. I did enjoy when he would say something like, oh, we're going to just stop playing war games with South Korea. And then they'd have to interview somebody from the cabinet and they would have to pretend that they knew that he was going to say that. And they all, absolutely, we knew that. I mean, no, he didn't write it down anywhere and he didn't actually say it to us, but he did. Oh, we knew he was going to do it. It kind of reminds me, do you know when your wife meets your neighbor and makes some excuse to your neighbor about why you don't have to go to some event that they're planning?
Yeah.
And then forgets to tell you.
Yeah.
And then you bump into your neighbor and you have to play guess my itinerary for next weekend. I don't know if you've ever had that. Oh, you can't go to little Timmy's birthday because you're going away for the weekend. And you're like,
I'm going to Ashgabat. Yeah.
I'm going to the place that I'm going to. But no, the point is you have no idea what she said. So you have to play it by ear. How long is it going to take you to get down? Oh, that depends on the traffic on the road, isn't it? No, seriously, how long will it take you to get down? Half an hour to 4 hours. Like you're just, and you're going to see your dad. How he's going to recover. How long will the recovery time from his little procedure? 6 months from a wisdom tooth extraction. Well, it was very complicated once they got in there. They had to give him a tongue transplant, and now he has the tongue of a cocker spaniel. And my mother's delighted, and now he licks his balls when he goes to sleep. But he was doing that before the operation. So, My point, anyway.
Yeah.
Is that you could say what you want about Donald Trump. So could I. Have you ever heard of the Goldwater Rule?
No, I have not heard of the Goldwater Rule.
If you're an American psychiatrist, part of the American Psychiatric Association, you cannot, how should I put this? You cannot give an opinion on Donald Trump, for example.
On a political leader?
No, on somebody that you haven't examined. So what happened was, Goldwater is familiar because Barry Goldwater ran for the US president's position. He was in the American presidential election in 1964, right?
Okay.
Fact magazine, which is now gone, published a special issue, imagine this, concerning this guy. He was the Arizona senator and the Republican presidential candidate.
Okay.
So he was up against LBJ. Magazine sent out an informal survey conducted a week after Goldwater received the nomination for president from the Republican Party. And this involved the distribution of a questionnaire to all of the nation's 12,356 psychiatrists saying, do you believe Barry Goldwater is psychologically fit to serve as president of the United States?
Wow. Right.
1,189 deemed him unfit. And then, of course, Fact went and published a magazine. It went, 1,189 psychiatrists think he's unfit. And he lost the presidential election.
Wow.
Now, he lost it for, people think that he lost it for various reasons.
Okay.
But a few years later, which is a bit odd, but it was 1973, the APA went, we can't let people do this. We can't have psychiatrists say this. So section 7.3 remains a component of the APA's principle of medical ethics, and it says that in relation to public figures or information publicly conveyed, it is unethical for a psychiatrist to offer a professional opinion unless he or she has conducted an examination and has been granted proper authorization for such a statement.
So you would have to actually sit with a, you know, some,
if you were a psychiatrist,
if you're a psychiatrist
from the APA,
and sit with someone who's a public figure to determine whether or not you're allowed to say this person is or is not fit to, or pass any kind of judgment on them.
Yeah. You can talk about psychiatry generally and that sort of stuff, but you cannot go, see that guy over there? Yeah. Yeah. Dressed as a chicken. Yeah. That guy dressed as a chicken, barking like a dog with one headphone in, signing copies of Mein Kampf upside down with a crayon he's just taken out of his own rectum. I couldn't possibly say if he was a little bit off kilter.
But hang on. So is it specifically people in positions of power, or is it, like, as you said, the crazy guy in the chicken suit?
Public figures would be the people who generate enough media that maybe the necessity or the occasion to comment on somebody would happen.
Gotcha. Right. So if they were brought onto, like, you know, one of those American rolling news coverage things about the, you know, gubernatorial race in Arizona, they would not be allowed to comment on any of the candidates unless they had literally sat with them and examined them.
If you were a psychiatrist from the APA, yeah.
Wow.
And specifically to them, yeah.
That is, I mean, it's probably a good thing. It does seem a little prohibitive, but it is probably a good thing in general.
Well, yeah, there is discussions about how, is it outdated or is it not outdated? And actually, we'll put in the show notes a little link to an article I read about it, because some people go, well, actually, no, it's too prohibitive.
Right, okay. Yeah, it is one of those things that kind of gets you down the middle. Like, you're kind of going, that's ridiculous. You're free to say what you want. And then you're like, well, in fairness, if it's influencing election results, it could easily be unfounded, and therefore you're pushing things that maybe you shouldn't be pushing.
Well, it's funny, I hadn't heard of it until Donald Trump became the US president, and it was amazing how quickly it was thrown to the fore once again, Dave, shall we say.
Didn't happen very often during Barack Obama's reign, but definitely during Donald's.
County Offaly's Barack Obama, please give him his full title.
Of course.
County Offaly, brackets, owner and proprietor of an exceptional service station, close brackets.
That is the thing. A lot of people outside of Ireland don't even know of the joy of the Barack Obama Plaza, which is the greatest name for anything ever. But it is literally a motorway services near the birthplace of Barack Obama's ancient Irish family. And it's got an amazing Supermax. It's got a big American car outside, doesn't it? Like a Cadillac or something. And you walk in and there's a kind of a life-size cardboard cutout of Barack and Michelle. Everyone gets their photo taken. I'm sure Americans going in there are like, what is happening? It'd be like, you know, it'd be like driving through like rural Iowa and pulling into the like Bertie Ahern Statoil. You'd be like, what is happening? Why is this here? Doesn't make any sense.
Of all the Taoiseach we've had, Bertie Ahern or Charlie Haughey would be the one who would have a service station that they had forgotten about in the middle of nowhere.
Gareth Fitzgerald would have a library, but the two boys would definitely have petrol stations.
Yeah, and you could only play cash at the Charlie Haughey one, wouldn't you? Cash. There'd be Charvet's shirts on sale. You know the finest piece of political analysis I've ever heard of Donald Trump was? I got into a taxi in West Belfast after he was elected. Did I tell you this?
No.
I got into a taxi in Belfast just after he was elected, and the taxi driver, we were talking about it, and he said, God, America is very partisan now, isn't it? You got all the Republicans on one side and all the Democrats on the other. I couldn't live in a place that divided.
This guy's like, from Belfast.
Yeah. Drop me the peace wall here, Seamus, and I'll have a think about that searing political insight that you've just come up with here.
Beautiful.
So they are my three short adjacent dictator facts.
Actually, do you know that I did my driving test, but the very first time I did it, I was 20. And the reason I did it was because I was going to Russia for a year at the end. So I went in my third year in university, I went to Russia. So I was 20. It was the summer. I was like, actually, if I'm going to get a job in Russia in the following summer, I might need to drive. So I better get my full license. So I went and did my test and I failed. And all I had was my provisional license. So in Ireland, you have two licenses. You have a provisional license and a full license. Provisional license is when you haven't passed your test, full license, obviously, when you have. So I went to Russia with my provisional license and said, ah, sure, when am I ever going to drive public transport in St. Petersburg, whatever. Got a job in the summertime. And the guys I was working for, a couple of Irish lads, they decided once they realized that I didn't drink, that they could use me as a taxi service.
Yes.
So I would make my plans, do whatever, go out with my friends, come home, get into bed. And then I'd have the mobile phone would ring. And I'd answer it. It'd be like, can you come down to Nevsky Prospect and pick us up? So I would hop in the big, they had a big Land Cruiser, huge thing. And I would get in that and I would drive down. Now, just let me paint a picture for you. In 1995, 1996 this would have been, in Russia, the police on the street, the traffic police, had black and white sticks. They're not like truncheons, but they were just black and white sticks. And they would put them out. And if you saw it, you had to pull in. You just had to pull in. And if you didn't pull in, there was another one down the street who would actually stop you and you'd be in serious trouble. So you're driving along your big blacked out Land Cruiser. And to be honest with you, you didn't really get stopped very often. And, it was kind of fine. But one night, the lads were absolutely steaming drunk. We had gotten in, I'd gone in and collected them, and I was bringing them home. And the guy stuck out his black and white stick. And I was like, oh, here's the last thing I need. So when we were chatting away, rolled down the window, and the smell of booze, like the absolute smell of it, just came wafting out. And he was looking at me going, whatever. So I had been told, if you're ever stopped, you're a foreigner, act like you don't speak Russian. I was fluent in Russian, but act like, Yano Gavaryu Paruski, you're silly, I don't speak Russian phrase. And you just keep saying that because they'll just get bored if they can't communicate with you. And none of them spoke English. So I'm doing this whole dumb thing. He gets me out of the car. He puts me in the back of his Lada police car while he and his friend get into the car. And they're having conversations. So the other guy's been talking to the two absolutely hammered Irish lads in the back, who are businessmen, probably well known to the police or whatever. In a good way, I mean, just as in...
Hold on. They're helping the police with the inquiries.
There
and they're
you go.
Well known to the Gardaí. So, okay, so these your friends are not major criminals in their blacked out SUV. Okay. They were keeping diamonds in their teeth as a decorative thing. They were not part of the Russian mob.
No, they definitely weren't. Anyway, I'm in the back, so I can understand every word the lads are saying, right?
Yeah.
The lads are looking at my license, and it's this green fold-out piece of paper, and they keep coming back to the word provisional, right? Because they're barely read English. They're trying to read, and they're like to each other, like, obviously in Russian, going, what is this? Like, do we know? I don't know this license. Like, I've never seen before. What is it? Whatever. So I'm sitting there kind of going, oh, Jesus Christ. Like, I'm going to go to Russian jail. This is just not what I need to be ringing my mother about tomorrow. You know what I mean? So eventually.
That wouldn't be my massive worry about. Wouldn't be my first worry about Russian jail. My first worry would be the massive guy with the teardrop tattoo and the spider web on his fingers. It would not be like, how's mammy going to take this?
We are very different people. Anyway, They turn around to me and start to ask me in broken English, what is provision? And I went,
yeah.
Oh, this is, and it was like, obviously had the 12 stars of the EU and it said EU on it. I said, this is province. I can drive in every province of Europe. And I started going, France, Germany, Poland. Now listen, off all the countries, and they were just like going, and obviously they just couldn't, they were just getting so bored of talking to me. They eventually just went, oh, here, and put out his hand, and I just gave him 10,000 rubles, and he just let me out the car, back in, and we went home.
How much was 10,000 rubles at that stage?
$2.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, what most people are going to take from that entire story is that I passed my driving test first time and you failed it. I think that's what most people are going to take from that.
Yes.
If you want to just, if you want to get that really in your head, maybe just press 30 seconds back in the podcast, put your... take off the speaker, put it in your headphones. Dave failed his driving test. But in fairness, you took your driver's test when you were what age?
20.
20. So at 20, I'm from outside of Dublin. So I've been driving 8-9 years at the age of 20. That's it.
You've lived away from home for 10 years.
I've lived away from home. People don't understand this, that if you were an international listener to this podcast, the legal age of driving is 17 in Ireland, which means that we've all been driving at least 5 years. Basically, the Gardaí, the cops, stop you and go, do you like country music? And you say yes. And they go, you're allowed to drive now. You've made your confirmation. Here's your provision. Some kids get their provisional driver's license as their confirmation gift. That's how it works in Ireland. Right, that's enough of our nonsense. Let's talk to an expert. In part two, we will talk to Richard Fitzpatrick, an author, a journalist, and a documentary maker. Did General Franco rig the Eurovision Song Contest? Can't believe I'm saying the sentence out loud. Richard will tell us.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com. Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Okay, welcome to part two. We are now joined by journalist, author and broadcaster Richard Fitzpatrick. Richard is based in Barcelona and he's written a brilliant book on El Clásico and made a documentary called The Year General Franco Stole the Eurovision. And we'll chat to him about the El Clásico again, but for the moment, we're talking about dictators and we're talking about Eurovision Song Competitions. Richard, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on, Neil.
Of course, we should be saying bienvenido.
Oh, look. Hey, hombre.
Here we go. Chad, do you want to get a room together? Or?
Hombre sabe solo un poquito en español. No mucho.
That's the only bit he speaks. Any other language he speaks loads of. I'm so delighted. I'm so happy. You're going to get a Russian guest on, aren't you, just to show off?
As soon as possible, yeah.
So, I mean, that does give a lot away the year General Franco stole the Eurovision. But before we get to why he might or might not have done it, we're talking about 1968 here, Richard, aren't we? So take us back to 1968. Like, how is General Franco and Spain generally viewed internationally at this stage?
Yeah, they were an absolute pariah in the international community. Like, it's difficult for us to comprehend now because, you know, Spain, the Spanish people are so like the Irish. We're both Catholic and very open and warm and that and relaxed. Like, the mañana culture here would be familiar to or acceptable, I'm sure, to a lot of Irish people and their temperament. But back in the 60s, they were under this long-running fascist dictatorship by Franco, the longest running in the 20th century. And it was brutal. Like, he obviously came to power during the Spanish Civil War in 36 to 39. But he carried on his reign of terror right up until his death in 1975. 6 weeks before he died, he carried out, I think it was 5 or 6 political executions. So he just had this obsession with wiping out his political opponents. So, like, in the 60s even, people were shocked. They were really disturbed by the violence of his dictatorship. His favorite method of execution was strangulation. Like, it was such a grisly method to kill political prisoners.
And sorry, Richard, was that his main target? His main target was political opposition, as opposed to, like, the image we have maybe of dictatorships of somebody walked down the street, said the wrong thing, got hauled in by the secret police, and then was next. So were the public under any threat?
It was political opponents, people who were looking to undermine his regime. So they would have been anarchists, big tradition of left-wing. His enemy in the Spanish Civil War was the Republicans, the left-wing people. So communism, which is a sister of anarchism, that was his great obsession, wiping out communists. And then regionalism, like, I live in Barcelona in Catalonia. Catalonia wanted to secede, as it does today, or half the population here does. So he was really nervous about separatists from the Basque country and Catalonia. So in the Basque country, there was, a terrorist organization, ETA, which sprung up. The Catalans weren't armed terrorists, but they were pushing, or they had aspirations for independence, which has gone back centuries. So he would like any kind of political activity that, and it could be pretty like basic innocuous stuff, you know, like protesting or putting up posters. You would get thrown into prison for like 6 years. It was really harsh sentences, and everybody was on edge. It was a police state. So, like, I've spoken to a lot of people who were alive at the time. People wouldn't get taxis because they knew all the taxi drivers were informers. The concierges in the buildings were informers. You couldn't sit out in a cafe and talk politics or talk anti-Franco stuff, and because you would be terrified about who was sitting in the table beside you. So people just lived in fear. So it was an awful environment to live in.
And if there was such a pariah on the international stage, you know, it seems odd to us, I think, that, you know, something so frivolous and joyous as the modern, particularly the modern incarnation of the Eurovision Song Contest, might be rigged by someone who was such a fundamentally serious and obviously very flawed human being. But were other countries saying that Spain shouldn't be in the Eurovision?
Yeah, there actually was. By 1968, there was a famous incident at the finals in 1964 in Denmark. It was staged in Copenhagen. And a protester, like a streaker, he managed to get on stage and had a placard, and he was calling for General Franco to be boycotted. So even in the rarefied environs of the Eurovision, people were quite agitated about it. And when Spain won in 68, the following year in 69, Austria boycotted it. the finals in Spain. Like even in France, say there would have been campaigns, you know, to boycott Spanish tourism, you know, with posters saying, tourists, there's no sunshine in the Spanish prisons. So everybody was kind of aware of what was going on in Spain.
One thing I wanted to ask was, I mean, we all holiday in Spain. It's probably the preferred destination for Irish people. And certainly internationally, Spain is one of the most visited countries in the world. I think second only to France in Europe, and France is the most visited country in the world. So would the tradition of tourism, I suppose it probably in the 60s and 70s wasn't quite in the prevalence it is today with package holidays and cheap flights and all those things, but would Spain have still been a destination for oblivious tourists who, you know, didn't care that Franco was in power or that there was this police state or oppression because they were just going on their holidays to a sunny climate?
Yeah, I absolutely would. And if you ask around, like because I live in Spain, it would come up in conversation more maybe. But I know people like my next door neighbor at home in Ennis County Clare. They went on their honeymoon to Sitges, just up the coast here from Barcelona. Yeah. That was in the late 60s. So the doors really opened for tourism in the country in the 60s. And again, anecdotally, I know a lot of people, young, you know, guys in their 20s at the time who would have come into Spain. And it was, you know, it was easy to get into the country. And for a tourist, it wasn't, you know, they wouldn't get into trouble or, you know, it wasn't a threat to them, you know, that the doors were open for these tourists. It was more for the citizens of Spain that had the difficulty.
So there's been this rumor for years in Spain that Franco rigged the 1968 Eurovision Song Competition. But how did this rumor actually see the light of day then? Like, how did it kind of get out into the mainstream?
Yeah, it didn't surface until 2008. So what happened was in Spain that year, they had a TV documentary on the momentous spring of 68, all the upheaval that spring, you know, it was the same across Europe. And one of the items in that program was on this theory, this rumor that the 68 Eurovision was rigged by Franco. So they got a guy on as part of the program, Jose Maria Inigo. He's basically the Terry Wogan of Spanish TV. He used to present the coverage of the Eurovision. He sadly passed away there about 4 years ago. Every year, right up until his death, a really charismatic figure. He also had a famous chat show in the 70s. He had this glorious moustache, kind of like a Otto von Bismarck. And he was a master. Like, you guys would appreciate his skills. The show, they used to get the best of guests like Gay Byrne in the Late Late Show in the 70s. You know, the top Hollywood actors, Bing Crosby, you know, Charlton Heston. And he used to do the interviews. And he used to be his own interpreter as well. So he would ask the person the question, the guest, and then he would translate the answer on the fly.
Oh, Neil knows how much that would be a dream for me. To ask the incisive question, then translate it into another language, get the answer back. Translate that back. Oh God, this is my dream.
Oh no, with great power comes great responsibility. I don't think that we could give that sort of stuff to you. I don't think you could be trusted with that.
No, it's too much power.
So on this 2008 show, what did this Spanish Terry Wogan, Spanish Gay Byrne say, Jose Mario Inigo? What did he say?
Yeah, he came out regurgitating the rumor that Franco had rigged it. So the theory was, At the time, it should just to explain the background. At the time, the Eurovision wasn't a telephone vote-in. The countries in the finals had judges, a jury, right. And on each jury there was 10 members, and those members were picked by the television station. So RT, for example, would have picked 10 judges, and as it happens, Charlie Bird, the famous reporter, his brother was one of the judges on the Irish jury. So all the different countries had their juries, and then the fix, as it was that the Spanish television network, Televisión Española, the BBC of Spain or the RT of Spain, they sent their man, this was a music agent, around to the different juries in Europe, or a select number of them, and got them to pay bribes to ensure that Spain won on the night. So the bribes took the form of, you know, promises to buy TV series, to give recording contracts to artists, possibly brown envelopes. But that was the theory.
So the suggestion is that So the man turns up from Madrid and walks into wherever, RTE, for example, and goes, "I like your series, Glen Rowe. How would you like if we played it all across Spain?
Glen Rojo.
And we like that band, Aslan. And we will play them on our international radio stations." And basically in exchange for votes and a nod and a wink. So that's the suggestion. That's the rumor.
That's the rumor. Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. And now 68, of course, is possibly the most famous song in the history of the Eurovision that didn't win. So La La La, the Spanish song. Beats what song? Dave, you're gonna love this.
And here's the test, right? I don't know what. So say to me, like, you know, sing La La La. I have no idea. So tell me the name of the song that was beaten and see if I can sing that.
Oh, of course you're going to know it. Congratulations.
Congratulations. Congratulations.
Cliff Richard!
Yeah, a 27-year-old Cliff Richard who's just had done his summer holiday. He's a massive
powers.
Peak of his powers. It gets better than that. Richard, tell him who wrote the song.
Our very own Phil Coulter.
From County Derry, from Derry itself. He had just won it with Sandy Shaw, Puppet on a String. So this thing...
Sorry, Phil Coulter wrote both of those songs?
Both of those songs. So Phil Coulter is vying to do it 2 years in a row. So they're strong favourites, Richard, yeah?
Yeah.
Oh, they're totally out and out favourite. England, yeah, like you said, Sandy Shaw had won it the previous year. They're the holders. It's on in the Royal Albert Hall in London. They're the home team. You've got Cliff Richard. I mean, he's like ginormous at this.
This is Harry Styles of 1968, basically.
Harry Webb.
And they have this incredible song, Congratulations. Like, it wasn't the best song never to have won the Eurovision Song Contest. It was the best song. Like, it sold 250 million copies or something. Like, it completely surpasses, say, Waterloo or anything.
So you're in the Albert Hall, right? Let's say the fix is in for the moment, right? How does the voting unfold then? Like, do the Spaniards just romp to an early lead?
No, it was very dramatic. Like, I mean, for me as a kid, the Eurovision was great. The drama of the voting, like, I was growing up in the early 80s. So it was fascinating to watch. And I gorged on this particular Eurovision doing the research for it. But the voting was really interesting. So France went ahead. France had won it, I think, three times at this stage. So they were a strong entry. They were ahead at halftime, or by the time half of the votes had come in. And then England surged ahead, and there was four countries in the running towards the last few rounds, England leading all the way.
Well, the UK, I suppose, rather.
Or the UK, sorry, forgive me. Yeah.
What is it? Royal
Le Royaume-Uni. Tu peux le faire en français aussi, hein?
So they were ahead by...
What's Spanish for fuck off, Dave?
I guarantee you Richard knows that one.
I think he probably does.
So France were tailing England and Spain, and also Ireland were in the mix. Ireland was Barry McGuigan's father was the contestant. All I want is a chance of a
lifetime. The chance of a Barry McGuigan's dad.
Yeah, famous. Do you remember him singing at Loftus Road in the 85 when Barry McGuigan won his world title? His father sung Danny Boy.
Yes, I knew he was a singer, all right. Yeah, Pat.
Oh, yeah, he won out of, like, I think 600 entries
God.
The Irish nod.
So the UK are doing reasonably well towards the end, with congratulations then.
They were doing so well that the ushers from the BBC came along to Phil Coulter and they said, "Phil, get up side stage. You're about to be pronounced a winner."
So he
was cagey. Yeah, he was nervous. And he was the co-writer. His songwriting partner, Bill Martin, a Scottish guy, was adamant. He was there, "I'm not going up. I'm not tempting fate." But Phil Coulter went up anyway, and he was waiting in the wings. And then, so three rounds of voting to go, Spain comes in to vote. And we know how these things work. You know, it was no surprise that Spain didn't give any votes to the UK or Ireland or France. But still, England big lead ahead. They were still 5 points ahead of Spain with two rounds to go. Germany comes in then and gives the UK no votes, and Spain 6. So Spain pulls ahead by a point.
None of the 10 German judges said, my favourite song is Congratulations. And 6 of them said it's la 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 la.
But 22 years after the World Cup final, 23 years after World War,
Maybe.
And Germany and Spain, they were close allies on, you know, in television terms as well. The following year, when Spain hosted the tournament, the German network loaned them colored cameras so they could film it in color. But yeah, that was the decisive vote, the Germany one.
So when they win, right, and our Spanish Terry Wogan, as I'm going to call him for the rest of the show, is he the only person who suggested that this was the fix was in?
No, there's so in the research I did for the radio documentary I did on it, I unearthed two record executives. So the Spain entry, there's a backstory to the Spain entry. It was sung by this 20-year-old singer, Masayel, but she was only drafted in at the last minute because the original singer for the song was a famous guy in Spanish culture called Juan Manuel Serrat. He's the kind of like Leonard Cohen of Hispanic music world. Yeah, Pep Guardiola would be a big fan of his, the Man City coach. And he is a Catalan from Barcelona, from the city here. And he was selected to go forward with La La La, but he's Catalan and he was singing the song in Catalan and he wanted to sing it in Catalan. So Catalan, the language, it's more than a dialect. It's closer to French than it is to Spanish. And during the Franco regime, the language was banned. During the Spanish Civil War, there was people killed for speaking Catalan. And after the Civil War, then it was, you weren't allowed to speak it in public. So he wanted to sing the song in Catalan. The Franco regime said no way. So he was dropped as the singer. And it was a very brave thing for him to do. Even making the stand, he risked getting imprisoned. And he was subsequently exiled in the 70s. So the record company he worked for, I interviewed the two guys who owned that record company. And they confirmed the rumor that the fix was in. They said that Serrat's manager, a guy, Lasso de la Vega, he went around to the TV stations in Europe on a promotional drive with Serrat in the run-up to the finals. And he was working under the aegis of the Televisión Española, the Spanish TV station. And that was when the votes were bought. He was the bagman, essentially.
I mean, we don't know the integrity of the Eurovision Song Contest throughout the ages, but you have this, like, I just can't believe that this was so important to Franco, you know, a man, as Neil described, you know, so serious, so invested in his own internal politics, that all of a sudden, you know, the glory of winning the Eurovision. I mean, you have images of Jesse Owens in Berlin, you know, the Olympics, whatever. And all of a sudden this upstart, you know, Cliff Richard was going to do the same to Franco in his back garden. And, you know, it just seems like such a bizarre thing to try to win and have the glory of.
Yeah, it is. But I do understand the logic why he would want to do it. It's like you say, it's like sports washing, the Berlin Olympics. You see it all the time. Try to whitewash a bad reputation. It would show Spain in a good light. It was trying to push itself forward as a modern country that was open to tourism. And what better way than this huge stage? Like 200 million people tuned in to watch the finals, the Royal Albert Hall, like a massive TV audience. And this is the Eurovision. I mean, we joke about it nowadays, you know, it's become a bit of a skit and a parody. But back in the 60s, it was massive. Like, you know, David Bowie and Dean Martin covered songs from the Eurovision. Like, you know, Cliff Richard was there on the night representing the UK. So it stood to reason, or there was a lot in it for Spain, for Franco, if they did get to win.
Did Cliff Richard or Phil Coulter think that maybe it might have been fixed?
Yeah, that's a great question. Interviewed Phil Coulter, he says it's very possible. You know, he could see how the voting, how the bribes could be done because it wasn't a TV vote. It was just these juries from TV stations, very easy to buy these guys off. He was saying it's unlikely that this guy Lasso de la Vega was driving around with crates of Rioja in the back of his van. but he could have been, you know, whatever it was.
Just he has a scales there and he just has some Manchego and he's going, will this do it? What about will this do? He's just randomly put delicacies.
Let me add the chorizo. Now what do you think?
Back up the paella truck. Beep, beep, beep. These people in Ireland, they drive a hard bargain. Just eventually some guy turns up with a stuffed donkey from you get in the airport. Okay, you are sold. The Director General of RTE. I've never had such a tough negotiation.
I'm just glad that the negotiations were this format in terms of, like, you know, a positive kind of bribe as opposed to, you know, if you don't vote for us, we'll land you in some kind of, you know, central Spanish prison. You'll never be heard from again in the middle of a desert somewhere, you know. Yeah. At least it was positive.
Yeah.
Do people in Spain think it was rigged?
I would say in Catalonia they do, yeah. Because, but I'd say you get a mixed bag. I think a lot of people, Spanish people, would more so than Irish people, they're completely paranoid here about bribery, about corruption. They've just got such bad experience of it. Their attitude is kind of shrug of the shoulders. Sure, that's the way the world works, you know. Yeah. So they're a lot more cynical or skeptical about how things work in the world. I know when I interviewed Inigo, he was very defensive about it, and he was putting it back on me. He was there saying, well, isn't it a surprise that Ireland, a little small island, has won it 7 times? You know, maybe you should be asking questions yourself about your own
country.
Right,
so it wasn't Manchego and paella, it was Guinness and butter.
Tater crisps, briquettes.
Who wants a briquette?
Do you believe it was rigged?
I have an open mind on it from all the research I did on it. And my background is in football, in soccer, and soccer is so dirty. Like, there's, you know, the bribery throughout the history of the European Cup, the Champions League. Even today, the president of La Liga says that there are games in La Liga fixed.
Could you give us a list of those ahead of the schedule? That would be lost a few bob to Dave on a match a few weeks ago. Talk about.
I'm still waiting, Neil.
So there's a lot of circumstantial evidence. There's also very firm evidence from a guy, Alfonso Ossia, a famous columnist with La Razón, a right-wing newspaper here in Spain. He said he had dinner with the guy at the center of this whole scandal, the head of Televisión Española. He had a dinner with him in 1980, and Razón was this guy. And he said Razón said the thing was rigged. We went around there. We bought the votes with bribes. It was all done in meeting rooms. He subsequently said, this guy Alfonso Yusea, that the Minister of Information and Tourism, who was the boss of the chairman of Televisión Española, he said that Franco told him in 1968, this is the year we have to win this song contest. If it doesn't happen, you and Razón are out on the street. That's the testimony of Isia. It's hard to know, like, all the principal actors are in the grave. Razón, the Televisión Española guy, Lasso de la Vega, the manager of Serrat, the singer who apparently was the bagman, and of course Franco himself, they're all in the grave. So
it would be quite funny if they did it and then just ashamedly, the year after they won it, put on all the stuff they'd bought. So, like, in 1969, it was just wall-to-wall French, like, bizarre cooking programs. Like, T.G. Carr, like, Ross Naruin was made his debut.
Finnish elk Spanish hunting. Very helpful. Very helpful for the Spanish people.
And an entire channel of Finnish elk hunting. Welcome to the Helsinki Games. We're going for a 12-pointer today. And Franco just went, yeah, what?
What are you saying?
Go on, you going to say something? Because you know what happened to the last person.
Oh, man, this is just kind of rocks my world a little bit because, you know, I believe in the purity of things like the Eurovision. And now to hear that there may or may not have been Manchego envelopes passed, it just makes me a bit sad, I'll be honest.
Manchego envelopes sounds like something you find in a lovely restaurant.
Do you know what? It's a great name for an album.
It
Manchego
is.
Envelopes by the Spanish Terry Wogan.
I would 100% buy that.
Everybody would.
Featuring hits such as La 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 La.
All royalties to Franco.
How popular was La 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 then? Is it one of those things that because we are a bit possibly snobbish in the Anglophone world and not exposed to Latin music in the way half of the world is, it kind of passes us by and you're going to go, yeah, but it actually sold a billion copies in South America and Spain?
Yeah, I was completely dismissive of the song, and like, I mean, a guy who would know more about music, Phil Coulter, is totally, he's there, like the lyrics, La La La, they're not going to win an Emmy for that. And he actually claimed that the song is a ripoff of the Beatles song.
We're going to rig the Eurovision. That one.
No, the Joe Cocker one that he covered, what was it? A Little Help From My Friends. He said the melody is the same. Like, the song was composed by the arrangement was done by the same, a German guy who did Strangers in the Night by Frank Sinatra. So it was, you know, serious people involved. But yeah, I was dismissive of the song, and I was kind of turned by the TV or the radio presenter of the Eurovision here in Spain. He said, look, it's a snappy kind of pop song. They did, it was a kind of masterstroke in a way, the La La La, because it would play to any audience. And the proof, I suppose, is in the pudding. It has survived. Like, it's made the duo Dynamica, the songwriters, about €1 million in royalties over the years. And wow. Yeah, it still survives to this day.
You're right, Neil, about Latin music. I mean, if I asked you who the biggest streaming artist on Spotify of 2020 and 2021, I'm 99% sure who that artist is.
Pitbull?
No.
Is it Despacito, that one?
Well, Daddy Yankee is related to it. It's actually a Puerto Rican artist called Bad Bunny. Bad Bunny is the most streamed artist on Spotify for the last 2 years.
Wow.
And, like, as you just said, most people don't know who Bad Bunny is. They might know him because he featured on a Drake song or a Cardi B song, whatever.
Yeah, but like, this side of the world, you mean?
Exactly. Literally the most streamed artist on earth
is Bad Bunny. But Richard, I must say, you have convinced me that Franco rigged the Eurovision.
Well, I'm glad. I'm glad Richard convinced you, because I don't have to break out my folder, which is entitled How Hitler Fixed the National Plowing Championships, which was the next one on the list. But we have some absolute crackers. We've got Mussolini in the community games.
Oh, my God.
It's a big Mosley that year.
Stalin and Fela, 92, was it?
Stalin and Fela as well. Oh, my God. What's that? Salazar and the Rose of Tralee. The Pinochet and the Rose of Tralee. Sorry, I always get those two mixed up.
Of course. Richard, muchísimas gracias. That is amazing. What a story. Thank you so much for sharing it.
Thanks, civilian. Muchas gracias.
Gracias a ti. Un abrazo.
Welcome back to part three of Why Would You Tell Me That? Well, Dave, it looks like General Franco, in an unexpected side to him, may have rigged the Eurovision.
May have. I mean, I suppose ultimately, you know, congratulations is a bigger, better known, more successful song. I know La 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 had its success in South America, whatever. But I suppose, you know, I mean, it's not surprising. I think it wouldn't be beyond him.
It
wouldn't be beyond him, is what you'd say about the fella. Like, I wouldn't be surprised if he admitted it in the pub.
Yes, and Spanish Terry Wogan, as Richard described him as, he was convinced of it. Various other people were convinced of it. Richard is convinced of it. That is enough for me, given that we are bound to, yes, trivia and fact on this, but the odd conspiracy theory.
A little bit of theory, a little bit of opinion never hurt any man.
Yeah,
except a few men who probably did hurt. But yeah, look, another fascinating episode and a lovely insight into a competition. We love the pomp and the campness and the performances of the Eurovision, but you don't really think of it as a political tool very often. So it's fascinating to look at it in that sense as well.
Yeah, there's a few weird stories connected to it. So I think we might do a special. We might do a Eurovision special. Because there's a few people who have told me a few different things where it has been influenced or they tried to use it to influence things and maybe we're not familiar with. So that,
amazing.
Keep an eye out for that in future seasons, because this is the end. of season four.
The end of season four. We've come to the end of yet another season. And I have to say, Neil, my interest is not waning. There's nothing about this that I don't enjoy. I stare into your beautiful eyes and we talk facts and learn each other. It's brilliant.
Well, season, you've got me saying season as well, which...
Right, which you want to say series.
I started saying series and you clearly, your Americanized influence has made me say season. And I'm okay with that. What really upsets me, I haven't told you this, but when you say airplane, I mean, that really upsets me.
What do you want me to say? Aeroplane.
On a cellular level.
What?
Cellular.
Airplane.
When you say airplane, it just, there's a little part of culture
Oh, I am going to do an entire episode on airplane versus aeroplane and figure out how many times I can annoy. Neil, the movies 1 and 2 were not called Aeroplane 1 and 2. They're Airplane 1 and 2.
I don't know. You're putting about 5 different A's in plane. Now, I say aeroplane. I don't say aeroplane.
Aeroplane. Like, aeroplane.
Well, I don't know about you, but there's these two young lads from down the road, the Wright brothers, and they really are just the stuff they come up with now. They've built this sort of contraption that appears to be able to fly.
Listen, I think if that's all I do that annoys you, I am doing well. I am doing very well because God knows my missus could list off an entire episode, an hour's worth of a Why Would You Have That episode of things that annoy her.
I'm not even criticizing you for saying it. It's one of those bizarre things that I don't know why. And it's airplane mode on a phone. I don't say put on aeroplane mode. Aeroplane mode is wearing one of those leather hats like Biggles and putting on goggles and having a fella spinning the propeller going, contact. So it is, I'm not saying it's logical, but it's just one
right,
of those
it's just one of those
anyway,
things. I'll explain the rest
of them in the next season.
Yeah, well, that's okay. Save the rest for another time. Let's round off series four as friends. See, I said series there for you. See, I'm being nice.
Ah, you're such a legend.
Let's round it off as friends. This has been amazing. We have educated each other and hopefully the people who listen as well. Thank you to everybody who tunes in. We know you do in your thousands. And honestly, I don't know about you, Neil, but like, it's still one of the things I'm most proud of is when we look at the amount of people who've listened to this podcast and go, wow, like we started at zero, which I know you start everything at zero, but we did not that long ago, started at zero. And here we are just over a year later, 4 seasons in, and we are absolutely flying, loving it. So thank you, everybody.
Yeah, I absolutely love it as well. And that's the end of me being sincere. If you want to listen to Dave, you miss him from the podcast because we are going to be off now until October. You can check out his brand new show on Today FM.
Yeah, actually, let's see how much you know me. What's the show? How's the branding going for this branding exercise? What is the name of my new program on Today FM?
Dave Moore, the Dave Moore Show on Today FM.
Well, I mean, they're two different things. Dave Moore and the Dave Moore Show are two different. Like, what's the official title?
The Dave Moore Show on Today FM.
Now I've got another thing to add to my list of things that annoy me about Neil Delamere. No, it's just Dave Moore on Today FM. That's all it is.
Yeah, but it's not just you sitting there. I mean, you have to talk.
It doesn't
like,
matter.
You have to have some degree of a show.
It's not called the Dave Moore Show. It's just called Dave Moore on Today FM.
Okay. Well, I mean, I've never heard your radio show. Like, in the 21 years you've been on various different stations.
No, that's not true. The only time you've heard it is when you've been on it, literally live.
No, I do listen to the 10 minutes before I've been on it, in case I can talk about something.
When you're at reception. Yeah, I get it.
At reception. Yeah, when it's forcibly beamed into my ears. Yes, I do then listen to it.
And given that the reception that Neil is talking about is the reception for at least 6 radio stations, a podcast network, it could be any station that's on, and he's like, "Geez, Dave sounds like a girl today. That's great. I've never listened to any of these things."
Yeah, but in fairness, it's on very early in the morning.
For a man like Neil Delamere, who has lived a comedian's life for more than 2 decades,
9 to 12.
The time that I get up at and the time that I do my show is so alien to you.
Here's my question. Here's my question to you, right? So I have listened to your radio show, obviously. When's the last time you came to a gig of mine?
I've never been to one of your gigs.
Yeah. Yeah. In your face. So if you want to be a decent human being...
No, actually, sorry.
Go on.
You have done a gig for my radio station. I was there. You were forcibly thrust upon my ears.
When was that?
Ah, some gig back in the day. There was some charity comedy thing.
Oh, okay.
you know, there was a load of comics in Neil Delamere.
I think the reason people listen to this show is the true bonds of friendship that we have demonstrated over the course of season 4. I don't know, he works in the radio. I don't know, he's some sort of joke monkey. Who knows? We've been put together by the algorithm.
Look, all I'm saying is I'm glad we did get put together by whatever algorithm did put us together, because it's some crack and this podcast is a dream to do. So I absolutely love it.
Okay, let me do the plug properly then.
Okay, go plug.
Listen to Dave Moore on Today FM between 9 and 12. Weekdays. It's a great show. I've heard it many times and I really love it.
I have also been to see Neil Delamere countless times.
Yes.
Countless, because you literally can't count them. Vicar Street.
Yeah.
Vicar Street is going to be amazing.
September 30th, I said.
You think Airplane's bad? You can't even say the number 30th.
30th.
So you mean to say like the last day of September?
Yes, that's what I should say.
Yeah. No, honestly, Neil Delamere, as you know, if you listen to the podcast, is an hilarious man. So go and check out his hilarious comedy shows. NeilDelamere.com/gigs is where you'll find out all the information you need to know about where he is gigging. And yes, definitely go to Vicar Street. That is one of the best venues for comedy that even Neil Delamere will be funny if you go there.
100 to 102 Today FM.
That's it. No one ever says that anymore. We're not even, like, we're available on all platforms. Listen on the app. Get the Today FM app.
If you've missed any of Dave Moore's ramblings today, you can go to your closest wax cylinder shop.
Listen, I think you should stand in the park where you used to do on the little box and do your jokes as passers-by go to their lunch and read their newspapers.
I've done too many gigs for that to be funny, man. That is way too close to the bone.
This is the end of season series serial 4. We're so grateful for listening. Keep an eye on our socials throughout the time we're not giving you podcasts. We're at Why Would You Tell Me That on Instagram. He is at Neil Delamere Comedy. I am at Dave Today FM. And we'll talk to you in October. Peace.
Bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.